This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When it comes to space, there is a lot to be excited about these days. Telescopes are scanning the farthest reaches of our galaxy, and we're learning more than ever about the origins of planets. Astronomers are asking the age-old question, are we alone? And scientists are unraveling the mysteries of dark matter. Here in our own solar system, there's a lot of cool stuff going on. You know, we just landed for the first time ever on a comet, and we just woke up a spacecraft that's going to get within shouting distance of Pluto. NASA has successfully launched a ship that could one day take astronauts to Mars, and private corporations are getting into the space race like never before. So it's a good time to talk about space. We're bringing in a panel of all-star space experts today, and you can join the conversation. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We want to find out from you, what gets you excited about space these days? Would you travel to another planet, even if you didn't have a return ticket? Are we alone, or is there life beyond our Earth? We want to hear your calls at 860-275-7266. My co-pilot on this mission into space today is Patrick Scahill. He's WNPR science reporter, and he writes TheBeaker.org. Patrick, thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Of course. Happy to be your co-pilot, John.
And he brought together this panel of experts, including Meredith Hughes, who's an assistant professor of astronomy at Wesleyan University, who joins us in studio here in Hartford. Hi, Meredith. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us from Yale University studios are Deborah Fisher, a professor of astronomy at Yale University. Hi there, Deborah.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to join you.
And our friend Priya Natarajan, who's joined us in the past. She's a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Priya, good to have you back on the show as well.
Thank you so much, John.
So we're just going to start off by asking some really simple questions. And Deborah, I'm going to start with you. The thing we really want to know is, what's exciting you about space right now? What's the big question you're trying to answer right now in your work?
Well, I think the biggest question is whether or not we can find Earth-like planets around nearby stars, because we want to target those as platforms where life might get started on other worlds. And what's been incredible in my career over the last decade is to see us go from this question of whether or not Earth-like planets or planets of any kind form at all around other stars to being able to make a statement that almost every star in our galaxy has a planetary system, and that small rocky planets are far more common than, say, gas giant planets. So this is an incredible paradigm shift.
Far more common. How much more common? I mean, how many rocky Earth-like planets are out there, do you think?
Billions. Billions and billions, absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised if most stars have rocky planets. And so now the only question is whether the roll of the dice that happens during planet formation happens to land those planets at a distance from its host star, where liquid water might survive, persist on the surface for a long time, and help life to get started.
So how do you search for these planets? Give us a little thumbnail sketch of how you're looking for these rocky planets that might be Earth-like in their way.
Sure. So the instruments that we use are called spectrographs, and we're looking at the spectrum of a star. So that's the light that's been spread out by a prism. And we see, the bottom line is that we're measuring with this technique the wobble of the star. So a lot of people don't appreciate that as planets go whipping around their stars, they're also tugging the stars around a common center of mass. So while we can't see the planets, we can see the wobble of the star. And this technique is called the Doppler technique. So we're building instruments in my lab to try and improve our sensitivity to get down to Earth-detecting precision.
And Deborah, this is Patrick. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about where that data actually comes from. So what are the instruments that you guys are using to collect that data?
Well, I've used instruments in California at the Lick Observatory, in Hawaii on the top of Mauna Kea, the Keck Telescope, in Australia, the Anglo-Australian Telescope, and in Chile, we built a spectrograph that we're using now that gets probably the best precision of any of the U.S. instruments, and that's at Cerro Tololo Observatory in the foothills of the Andes.
And you had mentioned that the sort of the volume of planets that you're detecting is increasing, and I'm getting from you pretty substantially in the past few years. I wonder if you can talk about sort of what's facilitated that change? What's made your eyeballs more sharp when you're looking up into the sky and looking for these planets?
Yeah, I think the biggest change has really, we have to give credit to the Kepler mission, which was launched by NASA, and also the Corot mission, which was launched by the European Space Agency. So these are space missions, and they stare at stars, fields of stars, and as a planet happens to serendipitously transit in front of the host star, it will block out some of the starlight, and we'll see a temporary dimming of light. And it's really that mission that's moved us from wondering whether or not other stars had Earth-like planets to knowing that they do. So that's an incredible discovery. And then in terms of the ground-based instruments that I've described that I've used now for almost two decades, we've actually bottomed out, I think, on our ability to detect planets with those instruments as they exist today. So that's why the innovation that we're working on in the lab to try and improve the precision so that we can actually find those planets that we now know must exist. It's a great thing. We know we're guaranteed of success. All we have to do is build the instruments to find them.
Okay, so you've got instruments that are finding things. Meredith is using instruments that are finding things. So let's talk about the things that are exciting you, because I think it picks up a lot on what we just heard.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested in very similar themes in my research to what Deborah was just talking about. You know, this big ultimate question that we're all interested in is what kinds of planets form around other stars? How frequently do planets form around other stars? And ultimately, are there environments that are friendly to life, and how common are those around the galaxy? So I approach that question from a slightly different point of view, which is to look at the regions where planets are forming and to look at the very youngest solar systems as they're just starting to emerge from their birth cocoons of gas and dust. So we look at disks around young stars. These are flattened disks of gas and dust that are left over from the formation of the star. We know that our solar system came from one of these disks. The planets in our solar system aren't buzzing around our star like bees in a hive. They're all going very orderly in the same direction in a flat plane, and that's because they formed in a disk. And so we can actually see these disks around other stars and look at the environments where planets are forming.
When you're talking about planet formation, I mean, give us a little bit of a sense of the environment that causes a planet to form that might be one of these rocky Earth-like structures that we're hearing about versus one of these gas giants that we have in our own solar system, and also I'm sure there's billions of those as well. I mean, what happens to make one like Earth and one like Saturn?
Well, that's a great question. And so we're really actively working on that at the moment. There are a number of things that go into it. How much stuff is available, how long the stuff is available, what type of stuff is available. One of the big questions that we're asking now is, so in order for a planet to become a gas giant planet like Jupiter or Saturn, it needs to have access to gas, hydrogen and helium, that make up the bulk of the mass of Jupiter and Saturn. And so for a long time, we were worried because the gas seems to disappear relatively quickly, and we think it takes a relatively long time for the cores of gas giant planets to form. But that's something that's changing with recent instrumentation. We've found that actually the gas might stick around a lot longer than we thought it did. So we think that most solar systems provide, like Deborah was saying, we think that most solar systems provide a really fertile environment for the formation of rocky planets. And then the question is how many gas giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn in our solar system also form. You know, there's a complicated interplay between rocky planets and gas giant planets. There's an idea, for example, that gas giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn in our own solar system, if you have a close resonance like Jupiter and Saturn in our solar system, that can protect the inner solar system and keep it a comfortable place for rocky planets like Earth to form and persist throughout the lifetime of a star.
Oh, that's very interesting. So you need these other larger planets to sort of hold everything in harmony?
Yeah, Jupiter does a lot of things in our solar system. One of the things it can do in our solar system is kick out little things like asteroids and comets that might otherwise come and smack into the Earth. Or if you have a big planet like Jupiter that forms out where Jupiter is and then migrates into the central star, which we know happens in a lot of cases, we see what are called hot Jupiters that are planets like Jupiter, but closer than Mercury to the sun. And so if a planet migrates from Jupiter's location in our solar system in past the orbit of Mercury, it can disrupt the presence of rocky Earth-like planets and kick them out of a solar system. So the interplay between the gas giants in the solar system and the rocky planets is really important for determining the conditions for habitable solar systems.
I think the one where a big planet like that became some sort of a hot planet or a second sun in the sky. I saw that in a movie somewhere, Patrick. We'll be talking about the movies later on. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking for now about real science. The real scientists here in Connecticut are doing in space, trying to find exoplanets, planets far, far afield of our own solar system. And we're talking today with guests from Wesleyan University and Yale University. Meredith Hughes joins us from Wesleyan. Deborah Fisher from Yale. In a moment, we'll be bringing in Priya Natarajan from Yale as well. Patrick, did you have some more thoughts on this while we're talking about planet formation?
Well, I guess the one question I would have, Meredith, would be, so how do you do that? How do you look inside these, you call them, I think, stellar cocoons was one of the words. How do you peer inside that cocoon?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a really exciting time right now to be doing this kind of work. I should say we do this with radio waves, and as a radio astronomer, it's particularly fun for me to be on the radio. Usually I'm looking at radio waves from space, and today I get to send out some of my own, so that's great. The main instrument that we're using right now is called the ALMA Observatory that just finished it's just finishing its construction in Chile, and it's the most advanced radio telescope that we've ever had, and it's really the radio astronomer's answer to the Hubble Space Telescope. And you know, it's not a competition between the radio observatory with ALMA and the Hubble Space Telescope, but they're very, very, they're very compatible. They're very—they help us approach the problem from two different points of view. So some of the first images that we've seen of these disks around young stars where planets are forming came from the Hubble Space Telescope. But the problem was that the Hubble Space Telescope gets blocked by dust. So dust blocks a lot of the light. We were only seeing the surfaces of the disk. Now with the ALMA Observatory, which can see through the dust, we're seeing deep into these protoplanetary disks, these disks of gas and dust where planets form, and we're actually seeing into the regions where planets are forming, and it's completely revolutionizing our view of how and when planets form around other stars. So it's a really exciting time to be working in this field.
And are there particular spots in our galaxy or in other galaxies that you're pointing ALMA to look at that sort of present very interesting questions to you as a radio astronomer?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that ALMA has allowed us to do that we were never able to do before is to look at the types of environments where we think the sun formed. So there are a couple of different places where stars and planets form in our galaxy. Most of the nearby ones are what we call low-mass star-forming regions, where they're pretty chill areas of the galaxy, right? The stars are spread out, they're low density, there's not a whole lot going on there. But there's a lot of evidence that that's not the kind of environment where the sun formed. The sun formed in what we call a high-mass star-forming region near a big, massive star that's spewing out lots of energy, like the Orion Nebula, which is in the constellation Orion that's familiar to a lot of people in the sky. So previously, we haven't had the sensitivity and the level of detail that we would need to look into those high-mass star-forming regions. But now with ALMA, we're starting to be able to do that. So that's something that we're actively working on, and it's a lot of fun.
So Meredith is clearly on Team ALMA. Priya, are you on Team Hubble?
Yes, I would say so.
It's not a competition.
It sounds like a competition to me. So Priya, talk about some of the work that you're most interested in right now. What's getting you excited about space? Does it have to do with Hubble?
Absolutely. So my work has focused on trying to figure out how to map dark matter. So this is matter that is the dominant component in our universe and yet remains invisible. We know that it exists because of the gravitational effects that it exerts, both on the motions of galaxies in the universe, as well as the bending of light. So that's where Hubble comes in. And the most exciting project right now is a fabulous data set from the Hubble Space Telescope, the Frontier Fields, which is data of a couple of locations in the universe where we know there's a lot of dark matter piled up. So these are clusters of galaxies that we know are large repositories of dark matter. And they act as lenses, as cosmic lenses, actually, as nature's telescopes. What they actually do is they bend light from distant background sources, typically the first galaxies to form, for example, and they distort the light that we see. So we end up seeing a systematic shape distortion. And sometimes we actually see even more dramatic effects, especially if we have very high resolution, like the Hubble Space Telescope. You can have a single image of a galaxy split into several different pieces, so several copies of the same galaxy. And we have a new project, a very deep look at several of these clusters that's turning up a very large number of these highly distorted arcs. And what's exciting about that is that because we know the distribution of shapes with which galaxies are typically born, we know the prior, we can look at these distortions and we can map out the distribution of dark matter in the lens that is actually causing all the distortions.
I'm wondering, can you just give us another couple words on dark matter so that we understand a little bit better what you're talking about?
Sure. So dark matter, we think, is made of some exotic particle as yet undetected, but it is the dominant component of all matter in the universe. About 90%+ of the matter content of our universe is dark matter. And so dark matter is stuff that is not ordinary atoms. That we know for sure. So whatever dark matter is, it does not sit on the periodic table. There's no gap on the periodic table that we're waiting to find. This is some really exotic stuff. But what we know about it, so it's invisible, it doesn't interact with the photons, so it doesn't emit any radiation in any wavelength. It just sort of sits there. And since it has mass, the only effects that we see that it exerts are gravitational effects. So it affects the motions. So, for example, there's a lot of dark matter piled around our galaxy in a halo. And what it does is you can measure the speeds of stars in our galaxy. And we figured out, actually Vera Rubin and Ford figured out in the 1970s, that the speeds of stars around the centers of galaxies are much faster than you would think if all the matter that we saw was just the visible matter. So they actually figured out that there was some other unseen matter that was exerting a gravitational pull on stars, making them whiz around much, much faster. And now we know that dark matter is smeared everywhere in the universe. There are places in the universe where it's smeared much more lightly, sort of in the entire cosmos. And then there are locations like galaxies and clusters of galaxies where it's really piled up in huge chunks.
Now, Priya, was that something that we knew when the Hubble Space Telescope was initially launched, or was it something that we suspected back then?
Yeah, we suspected that theoretically there was a very nice theoretical structure for structure formation, a theory that was postulated on the fact that you had these cold, very slow-moving dark matter particles that interact only gravitationally. So our entire sort of understanding of structure and galaxy formation in the universe, we knew this dark matter was in the driving seat, and it was the scaffolding. But it took the Hubble Space Telescope to really confirm at least the lensing effects that are produced by dark matter. I mean, the first highly distorted arc was found with a ground-based telescope, the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, in the late 80s. But it was only after Hubble's vision was corrected in 1996 that we had a really sharp vision and we could start seeing the effects of these cosmic lenses.
And so now with the Frontier Fields Project, you're essentially, and please tell me if I'm wrong, taking sort of the deepest look ever that you've done with the Hubble Space Telescope back into sort of the origins of our universe?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are looking at these cosmic lenses, which are about 11.5 light years away. And they are bringing into focus objects that are even further back, so the first galaxies to ever form. And the reason these objects actually act as lenses is because they actually magnify faint background objects. So they're going to bring into view, they have brought into view, the most distant galaxies ever that you could never, ever reach with any telescope that we could ever build. Of course, there's a lot of serendipity here, right? So it's whatever happens to line up because behind one of these cosmic lenses. So with the Frontier Fields, we've just discovered that we found a very faint galaxy that probably formed when the universe was less than a billion years old.
Very cool.
Well, there's lots of cool stuff still to talk about. We're answering some of your questions about space. When you call us at 860-275-7266, we'll get to some of your calls in a moment. We'll continue talking about dark matter and exoplanets. We're also going to be talking about some of the new missions we've got right now, comets, trips to Mars, a spaceship to Pluto. We're talking with Priya Natarajan from Yale, along with Deborah Fisher from Yale, Meredith Hughes from Wesleyan University, and Patrick Scahill, WNPR science reporter. It's space here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow from 1 to 2 p.m., the Colin McEnroe Show goes to the Old State House at Hartford to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the Hartford Convention, where Federalists and Republicans clashed over taxes and war. Does that sound familiar at all? We'll be talking about this in the context of some modern-day issues. Hope you can come join the debate. It's from 1 to 2, the Colin McEnroe Show, live at the Old State House in Hartford. Today in the program, we're talking about space, some of the really cool stuff that's happening in space exploration today with Deborah Fisher and Priya Natarajan from Yale University. They join us from the Yale studios today. Meredith Hughes is with us in studio. She's from Wesleyan University. And Patrick Scahill, WNPR science reporter, who also writes our science blog, thebeaker.org. We've been talking about some of their work, but now we're going to turn to some of the news in space right now. And there's so much to talk about. Meredith, I'll turn to you, but I'd like Deborah and Priya to just sort of jump in. The thing that we're reading about today is the spaceship that got sent to Pluto called New Horizons, and it's going to give us a close-up view of Pluto. Why do we send a ship to Pluto? Are we excited about this?
Of course we're excited about it. Even though Pluto's not a planet anymore, we're still very excited about it. So Pluto is one of these objects that we call Kuiper Belt objects now. That's actually why Pluto stopped being a planet, right? Is because just like when we discovered the asteroids, and the first asteroid discovered was called a planet, and the second asteroid was called a planet, but then they figured out there was a whole belt of them, so it became the asteroid belt. Pluto was the first discovered, and it was a long time until they discovered the next few, but now we know that there's a whole belt of objects in the outer solar system. And, you know, in fact, Pluto is particularly interesting to me because it provides hints to what the conditions were in the early solar system and how the solar system formed. But New Horizons is going to look at it's going to give us the first views of the surface of Pluto and the system of Pluto. Pluto isn't hanging out there by itself, right? It has a system of several moons around it now. It has one moon that's very large, that's comparable to the size of Pluto, and now we know that it has several other smaller moons as well. And now we'll get a sense of what's going on the surfaces of those objects. Actually, radio telescopes have given us a hint about something interesting going on the surface of Pluto, which is a sort of reverse greenhouse effect. The temperature of Pluto is lower than you would expect given its distance from the sun, which generally determines how warm things are in the solar system. And so we're really interested to see what the surface looks like and to figure out what's going on the surface of Pluto.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things, too, because you're talking about radio telescopes a lot. The radio telescopes are allowing you to find such interesting things, but sometimes it takes the actual pictures. It takes us actually being able to see, not only for scientists to do some of the work they're doing, but also to capture our imagination about what things are really like.
Yes, absolutely. I think we're all extremely excited to see what the surface of Pluto looks like. It's an object that kind of looms large in all of our imaginations, and I just can't wait to see those first images of the surface.
Deborah and Priya, any more thoughts about this New Horizons mission?
Just that, yeah, it's incredibly exciting. We've been waiting a long time for New Horizons to get out to Pluto. It's already discovered some of the additional moons in Pluto. And what we learn about this object will tell us about these, you know, hundreds of other objects out in the Kuiper Belt and will tell us a lot about planet formation, in fact.
When we say we've been waiting a long time, how long have we been waiting?
When was the launch? Launch was around 2007, I think.
2007.
Yeah.
So,
and this was a ship that had to be, I think, woken up multiple times when it was sent out. And it just seems to me like quite a feat of engineering for me to wrap my brain around.
Well, it's quite a feat of engineering. But I have to say, the thing that fascinated me even more, as cool as it is to send out something toward Pluto, and then 7-8 years later, we start to get some word back from it. The idea that we've actually landed a rover on a comet is one of the most remarkable things that I think I've ever tried to grapple my head around. I don't know if you have some thoughts about that, Deborah and Priya, because this Philae mission that allowed us to see and also get some of the samples back, some of the actual close-up views of this comet, seems like something that gives us as close a look into the formation of our solar system as anything else we've kind of ever done in NASA and science.
That's true. I mean, the comets and asteroids are the leftover debris from planet formation. And as Meredith was saying, the images that we're getting really help us to imagine and ask new questions. And one of the images from the ALMA telescope that Meredith was talking about is an image of a star, a young star, HL Tau, where we see this incredible disk that's been carved out, sculpted by planet formation. And the star is about 1 million years old. So putting, all the stuff is good. You asked before, you were sort of joking about whether we were competing with each other. I think every aspect of science connects with another. So the ALMA observations, you know, the data that we're getting on comets and asteroids now in our own solar system, going out to Pluto to understand what's there, these things are all interwoven.
And I wonder if, and anyone can jump in on this, but if when we're just talking about data, it seems to me that there's a lot of things going feeding into that. So I know, Deborah, in your work with analyzing light curves that you're gathering through the Kepler telescope to find planets, a lot of that data you're now farming out to people to actually look at those light curves and getting citizen scientists involved in the project. And then with missions like the Rosetta mission, we're getting the lander Philae is tweeting as it's coming down, and pictures are coming back in kind of real time. And I wonder, just sort of, people seem to be a more intimate part of this process now. And I'm asking a very imprecise question here, but I think that's important when we're exploring the universe, that citizens are part of this process as well.
Yeah, I think that there's actually been a lot of success with sort of crowdsourcing help from citizens for the classification of galaxies. So one of the forerunners of this effort was a project called the Galaxy Zoo, which got citizens to classify galaxies. And what was very exciting about that is not only did we train citizens to help classify some gargantuan task, and that humans are more reliable than any automatic search algorithms that you could come up with, that, you know, exciting science came out of it. I actually wrote a paper with a citizen scientist who found this very peculiar kind of light echo, which we figured out was the dying gasp potentially of a black hole, the center of a galaxy. So the sort of the science rewards, the fact that, you know, science advances with the group effort of citizens who are interested and excited, is just absolutely fabulous. But I think, for the record, I want to say, for me, Pluto is still a planet. I went to school. I just can't get that out of my head, you know, so I have to say.
Okay, so Pri says planet. Deborah, is it a planet or not a planet?
Does it matter?
Okay, good answer. Good answer. Meredith, is it a planet or not a planet?
Well, I think if you believe that Ceres is a planet, then Pluto has to also be a planet. Ceres was the first asteroid discovered. But I have to say, I come down on the side of Pluto is the first discovered and one of the most exciting of the Kuiper Belt objects.
Okay. It's a good diplomatic answer. If you have questions for us, 860-275-7266. Okay. We all know Mars is a planet, right? And we've been hearing for years about whether or not the United States is going to launch some sort of large-scale Mars mission, whether or not it's going to be a goal like we used to have to go to the moon to send someone to Mars. Meanwhile, there have been all these others, including people in kind of the space tourism business, who've been thinking about sending people to Mars. I'll ask you first, Meredith, should we be excited about Mars? And what about Mars should we actually be thinking about? And what are the big questions about Mars that we might want to answer as we're starting to gather up all the resources to think about sending someone there?
Yeah. So one of the things that we really want to know about Mars is, what was the history of water on Mars? And this is an important question for habitability, because in our solar system, so you know, Deborah looks for habitable planets, right? And in our solar system, there are probably three planets that we would classify as habitable if we were looking at them from a distant solar system. And those are Venus, Earth, and Mars. And I think we all know, right? Earth is a pretty great place to live. Venus, on the other hand, rains sulfuric acid, so that's not such a great place to live.
If we ever complain about Earth, try Venus someday.
Yeah,
not a great place.
Exactly. And so the question is, so Mars is not particularly habitable for humans at the moment, but it may have been in the past. And so by going to Mars, by looking at the geology on the surface of Mars, in a way that is much easier to do with humans, who are very flexible and adaptable, than with the rovers that we've sent so far, I think we're going to learn a lot about the history of Mars, and we're going to learn a lot about habitability of planets in the solar system. And I think also it's important to keep in mind that it would be incredibly inspiring to multiple generations of humans on Earth to see humans walking on the surface of another planet. The moon landings were before I was born, right? And so in my lifetime, and now I'm a professional astronomer, I have seen nobody walk on the surface of another planet. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I want for my generation, for the generation after. And I think it's going to be incredibly powerful to see people on the surface of another body in the solar system.
What should excite us about Mars, Deborah? Is it about having people walk around there? Is it about some other science that you think we could bring back?
I think it's about the science. And to me, the exciting thing about Mars is it's pretty clear now that Mars did have water, as Meredith suggested. We see these fluvial features that look like dried riverbeds. We see these agglomerates. They're called nicknamed blueberries that were discovered by the rovers. These are mineral crystals that form rolling around in lake beds on Earth. So Mars probably had water at a time when the Earth didn't, when the Earth was very hot because of the heavy bombardment phase that we went through. And so there's been a suggestion that, you know, life got started or, you know, on Mars. And then there's some exchange of material, as we know, between all of the planets, between Earth and Mars and vice versa. And so maybe the, you know, early life, progenitors of life, you know, started on Mars and came to Earth. So I'm most excited about the idea that we'll have humans there digging down under the surface and trying to find something that's alive or some fossil of something that used to be alive. And then asking the question, does this look like life on Earth? And to me, the most exciting answer would be no, because it would mean that life could spring up independently on two different planets in our solar system. And then the odds for life elsewhere just go through the roof.
And Priya, what would it take for humans to get to Mars and do that exploration?
Oh, well, I mean, technologically, you mean, well, first
I mean,
of all,
sort of, where are we at now? Because, like, we hear all these different takes, like 2025, Mars 1, 2030s is what the Obama administration is saying. Show me the engineering plans. Like, can we do this? Is this feasible?
No, not yet. But I think that we need to, of course, pump a lot of money and bright minds into research, into developing the technologies that would actually enable us to do this. And so the current limitation, I think that there's no limit to what we can figure out if we dedicate both intellectual and economic resources to it. So I don't think this is fantasy. I think this is going to happen in my lifetime. I'm very, very hopeful. Although my own personal gaze, right, is further afield. The project that the window that I would want to see really open in my lifetime is the detection of gravitational waves from the mergers of black holes. So, you know, Einstein's predicted them, and we have a pretty good idea that they ought to be there, but that's an engineering task that is very, very hard, to hear the sort of the dying gasps of merging black holes. So for me personally, that's the window that I would like open. And that would also take a lot of resources. There are there's a European study mission called ELISA, and then a LISA mission, a space interferometric mission. I'm really hoping that that gets done in my lifetime.
You know, it's interesting because I think it's another one of these splits. Again, not that there's competitions, but there really is a big divide, I think, even amongst the American public about what sort of science we want NASA to be doing or what sort of science we want to get out of space. And Priya, you're talking about something that's very specific that maybe doesn't have the same visuals as people walking around. And I'll ask you first, Priya, but I'd like everyone to give their take on this. It's going to cost a lot of money and take a lot of time to get any person to the surface of Mars and have them actually live through it and get pictures back. And the divide between those who support manned space travel and those who support unmanned space travel of the type we've been talking about so far, these missions to Pluto, into a comet, this is bringing back amazing science, all the work that you're talking about, Priya. So strike that balance for us. I mean, how much time, effort, and energy, when we have, you know, only a limited amount of each, should we be spending on getting people to a place like Mars versus spending time just developing the instruments that allow you to do what you're doing around, say, something like black holes?
Right. Well, I think you're absolutely right that it's a question of organizing priorities. But I mean, in terms of intellectual goals, I think it's perfectly fine to have a lot of different people focused on many different problems, because I mean, the universe is wondrous. There are many, many different phenomena that, you know, are waiting to be explored. Personally, I feel that, you know, getting a sample back from Mars would be exciting, but that doesn't necessarily require a human being to be trampling around there. And in terms of inspiration, I think that, you know, the amazing images of the distant universe are pretty captivating. I think the public is captivated both by, images of the solar system and beyond, but I think, you know, we should reach near and far. There is no reason to pick one over the other. And I think that, you know, the question of which are the sort of burning questions, there'll always be a split. There'll always be a split in the scientific community because of interests. For example, I am really interested in what is mysterious, what's invisible, and what is completely unknown, and what appears to be important on a very, very grand scale. So, for example, we know that there's really no dark matter in the solar system. So, you know, you can't go out and scoop some dark matter while you're walking on Mars. So, unfortunately, you can do these two pieces of science, which would be transformative. And I think it's a question of personal appeal. To me, the large-scale questions are just so enigmatic. I mean, how come we live in this very peculiar universe that is dominated by the stuff that's dark matter, and we are a mere 4%? And how can we not know and figure out what the rest of the stuff is? And, you know, I think that, you know, gravitational lensing, you know, all the sort of exotic stuff, phenomena that really attracts me personally. For example, gravitational lensing. Why am I interested in gravitational lensing? Because I think looking at the clumping of dark matter, characterizing these lenses, right? So what I do personally is I'm an optometrist. I actually kind of calibrate this cluster lens and figure out how clumpy dark matter is. And the hope is the clumpiness of dark matter will reveal its nature. So a lot of us are focused on sort of the fundamental physics questions of the composition of the universe. I think they excite us.
One of the things that should be reassuring to people is that astronomers do something that I think is really incredible. We have a decadal survey where every 10 years, the leaders in our field come together and we decide what the priorities are for the next 10 years. We know as astronomers that we believe our work is important. We believe that we are the vision plan for humanity. But we also know that what we do is expensive and that we have to be thrifty and smart about the way that we approach science. So I think it's one of the really great things that traditionally astronomers have done is get together and every 10 years write a report which says how much should be invested in, you know, searching for black holes and dark energy and dark matter, and, you know, what are the biggest priorities right now for the community. And so that's a chance for all of us to get together and reach consensus.
You know, I agree with everything that Deborah and Priya have said so far. It's important to look near, to look far, to prioritize, to think about how we spend our research dollars. I do want to put in another plug for manned space exploration, though. And the point that I'll make is a little bit of a science fiction point, but I don't think entirely. And that point is that, you know, first of all, the decadal survey wouldn't consider a manned mission to Mars because it's not actually technically an astronomy project. It's more of a manned space exploration project that would fall under a different category within NASA. But thinking about the future of our species, you know, if you really think extremely long term about the future of our species, we're in a precarious place living on this tiny little rocky planet in this tiny little solar system. And the Earth will be around for a long time. We've got several billion years before the sun gets big and engulfs the Earth. However, you know, there's a certain risk. We're having our entire species, the entire history of Earth on this tiny little orb. And I think it's natural to think about the future of the human species, to think about expanding to different worlds, to different, maybe ultimately solar systems. And the moon was the first step, and Mars may be a next big step for us as a species. So while I do think that it's sort of a longer term goal for us as a species, I think it's an important thing to keep in mind for our survival.
That segues nicely into what we're going to talk about after our break, the movie Interstellar, and whether or not we actually have to get off this little tiny rock and travel way out into the distance and have some pretty dodgy dialogue along the way. We're talking today with scientists who study space. We're talking with Meredith Hughes from Wesleyan University, Deborah Fisher and Priya Natarajan from Yale University. Our own Patrick Scahill, our science reporter, who writes thebeaker.org, is here as well. You can join us at 860-275-7266 with your space questions or tweet them at Where We Live.
I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space. I'm bringing rockets back.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Governor Dan Malloy is shaking up his cabinet. Some of the ghosts of legislatures past find some new jobs. And we'll also take a look at New Haven, where the police chief is making headlines for a confrontation at the Yale Bowl. Join us for the Wheelhouse tomorrow here on Where We Live. Today, we're talking about space, some of the things that are getting the leading space scientists excited. We're talking with Deborah Fisher and Priya Natarajan from Yale University, Meredith Hughes from Wesleyan University, and Patrick Scahill, who's WNPR's science reporter. Okay, Meredith set this up for us. You know, she's talking about we got to get off this rocky planet eventually. It's not going to sustain life forever. We got to look out into the far-flung galaxies for a new place to live. Patrick, this is the premise of the film Interstellar. Mm. I have to say, this set off a heated debate at the offices of Science Friday, where I work sometimes. Mm-hmm. Everyone there loved the movie. I sort of didn't love this movie. What are your thoughts quickly, Patrick, before we get into this?
Well, I mean, I could give you my whole thoughts about the narrative structure of the movie, and I won't. But overall, I mean, and through speaking of scientists, I'm getting the sense that the science within this movie compared to a movie, say, like Gravity, was actually pretty good. And that the consensus was, yeah, actually, they got a lot of things right. And from the standpoint of a layperson who's excited about space, it got me excited about space. And I think that's what any good science fiction movie should do.
It got me excited about space, too, but it also got me excited about Matthew McConaughey maybe not talking so much in space. But that being left aside, so Priya, you study black holes. They go through a wormhole first, and then they're I'm not giving anything away that you probably can't figure out, but they end up on a planet that's right next to a black hole. Is any of this even feasible at all?
Actually, I think so. I have to say first, I absolutely loved the movie.
Of course, you did.
of course, I did. Yes. So but I have to add that, you know, my Bollywood watching movies came in handy. It was a bit too long for me, but I loved it, and I partly loved it because the executive producer. So this is what is special about this science fiction movie, right? So for the first time, you had a black belt general relativist who probably understands black holes better than almost anyone else around. Kip Thorne from Caltech, who was the executive producer, made sure that all the science was actually right. And so he's a friend of mine, so I'm slightly biased. I thought it was fabulously done. And yeah, it's plausible. Okay. There's nothing here that violated any law in physics.
Including the planet that's on this precipice of a black hole?
It could hover, yes. Yes, it's potentially possible.
Yeah. It's potentially possible. Deborah?
Sure. Absolutely. There are definitely stable orbits around black holes.
Oh, yeah, there's stable orbits
around
black holes.
Yeah, and in this case, the lucky case was that the accretion disk around the black hole had a gas temperature that's the same as the temperature of the surface of the sun and provided this lovely environment for these planets, nice. Which are circling the black hole. And, you know, I'm not sure how stable it'll be forever, but
it could potentially be stable
years.
Forever, yeah. Actually, yeah. Because there are some sweet spots, yeah, where you could be trapped forever.
Yeah.
Of course, a slight nudge could push you right in, but
right.
I think, you know, for our purposes, you could be locked in there stably forever.
Yeah.
Meredith?
So I have to admit, I'm ashamed. I haven't seen the movie yet.
You haven't seen the movie? I kind of can't believe that, although you're probably, you know, busy doing science and stuff.
Well, once in a while.
And Meredith, I think one of the things that you are looking at is actually looking at real black holes, right? Like ALMA is looking at black holes at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of the really exciting developments in radio astronomy in the past few years. There's a project called the Event Horizon Telescope, and what they've been doing is they've been combining the capabilities of many radio telescopes around the world. The plan is to add in ALMA soon, although they haven't done so yet. And they've actually made a lot of progress on imaging the region directly around a black hole. So we have a lot of predictions from theorists like Kip Thorne and others of what it should look like around a black hole. But now with radio telescopes, we're actually getting to the point where we're seeing near the event horizon of a black hole, and we're taking pictures of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's really amazing.
And have we ever seen anything go into that black hole? Have we ever observed that process?
So there was a cloud that was passing near the black hole at the center of our galaxy that we thought might get sucked in and we might get to watch that process. It turned out not, and it turned out to be interesting for other reasons. But so we see lots of evidence of material being accreted into the black holes at centers of galaxies. We've never watched that process up close with the imaging capabilities like we have from radio telescopes now. But in fact, the energy that's released when matter falls into a black hole powers what we call quasars, which are basically the stars of the radio sky. Optical stars are very faint at radio wavelengths, and so we see quasars all around the sky. If you had eyes that could see radio light, the stars that you would see in the sky would not be stars. They would be material falling into supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies. So it's actually something that we see all the time, in a sense.
So
I was just going to say that we actually do see the supermassive black holes that are accreting and gobbling a lot of gas out far out into the distant universe. So all the way out to when the universe was about 2 billion years old. And we also see these events called tidal disruption events, where you have a star that sort of strays close to a black hole, but we haven't quite seen one up close yet. But we are seeing these sort of flares that are likely disruptions of stars that sort of cross this forbidden zone around a black hole.
Let's go to Jim in Guilford. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, so I'm an amateur astronomer, and I live in Guilford. And listening to you talk about the going to the moon and the Mars, and one of your guests who wasn't even alive back then made me remember one of the most inspiring books I've ever read, which is A Man on the Moon by Andy Chaikin. Mm-hmm. And it's really about the human story about going to the moon. And for anybody who doesn't feel connected, they should read it. It's something, the only book I can remember reading twice.
and obviously inspired you. And between that and, Jim, thank you so much for your phone call. Between that and actually seeing things like the Apollo missions, many people still remember that feeling. Just quickly, because we just have a couple minutes left, do you feel, Meredith, that there is this excitement around space that maybe between some of the movies we're talking about, but also some of these brand new missions that are sending back these amazing planets, that we can get a populace that is excited about this in the way that maybe we were back before you were born, and just as I was being born, and people were thinking about this as a real frontier and a place that we should consider not only sending people into, but just more instruments into as well?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the iconic images that I saw created after the landing, the Philae landing on the comet recently, is a montage of images of all the surfaces that we've landed on in the solar system. And it's actually amazing. We've landed on a lot of surfaces, and our robotic spacecraft send back images from people where from places where we just can't send people yet. And so to see, you know, a horizon shot from the surface of Mars, from the surface of Titan, which is the largest moon of Saturn, from the surface of a comet, from the surface of an asteroid. It's amazing to put these surfaces next to each other and to think about all of the places that we have been in the solar system. And by we, I don't necessarily mean people, but I mean our robots. Robotic exploration of space is incredibly inspiring. You know, there's something else about sending people there and about sending people's artifacts to these places. But I'm pretty inspired by the work that we've done with landers and robots.
Deborah, we just have a minute left. I mean, what's inspiring you right now? I mean, do you think that we're entering into a new age in which we're going to be talking and thinking more about space as a human race?
I sure hope so. I think it's incredibly exciting. I think that part of our destiny is to travel out into space. But like Meredith, I think that, you know, there's a lot of work to be done first to send little spacecraft out to explore nearby solar systems, and maybe to carry along some of our DNA with instructions for replication somewhere else.
And Priya, I'll give you the last word on this. What do you say?
Well, I think space is the final frontier, and it remains so. I think we are destined to look onward and really far into the horizon, well beyond our solar system, and maybe into other universes. I think the idea that there may be other universes out there waiting for us to discover is super, super exciting, and that we may see their shadows. We may never quite be able to get there. We'd need a very awesome wormhole that would get us into a different universe. But I think the possibilities and, you know, it's a combination of human imagination and what we can actually do, it's just incredible.
Well, Priya, could you go find that awesome wormhole for us?
Yeah, okay. I will.
she'll do that after lunch. Priya Natarajan
is
a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Deborah Fisher is a professor of astronomy at Yale as well. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
And they both joined us from the Yale University studios. Thanks to them. Meredith Hughes is an assistant professor of astronomy at Wesleyan University. Great to see you, Meredith. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks.
And Patrick Scahill is WNPR's science reporter who writes TheBeaker.org, our science blog. Thanks so much, Patrick. This was a lot of fun.
It was. Thanks, John.
Our program is produced by Betsy Kaplan today, along with Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Kyone Wolf, the executive producer, is Katie Talarski. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. I'm John Dankosky. Go explore. This is Where We Live.